I arrived at night at the very end of July 2005, left the Pudong airport, got picked up by the hotel, driven throughout a lot of rural Pudong, the farmhouses and low buildings out there for about 45 minutes, and I thought that was Shanghai. The shape of the bubble in Shanghai is different than the bubble might be in other countries. It gets distorted by many things. Some of it is China's visas policy. Some of it is cultural. But for example, we don't have any lower or working class expats here. My mom said, "Well, we want to go visit your grandfather's church in Beijing." And I said, "Why would grandpa have a church in Beijing?" She said, "Oh, well, you know, he was born in Beijing." So it's a bit difficult to answer the question exactly of where I'm from, and I'm a little bit caught between both worlds. And so all of that has made me into this kind of permanent outsider.
City原来如此，大家好，欢迎来到如此城市，我是好汉。我们这一期节目的讲述者是一位美国人沈凯伟。 那他在 2005年 由于意外的机会来到上海，一待就是近20年。我记得第一次见到他的时候是在上海梧桐区的复兴西路，他当时指着窗外说他感觉这里就是他的故乡，因为这里每一栋的建筑在过去10多年的变化他都了如指掌，而他真正的故乡迈阿密反而显得有些陌生。他最近把自己的沪标经历写在了《洋盘》这本书里。 他在里面介绍了在沪外国人的小社会如何运转，也讲述了他所见证的中国加入 WTO 以来上海这座城市的全球化故事，还有他外高祖父与晚清北京的家族往事。正如他的书名的英文原名 Outsider， 身处异乡，沈凯伟也有自己关于自我认同的困惑。 而对于扎根在此的他来说，上海却是那个让他生命热情得以延续的地方。那接下来，我们可以听听沈凯伟与他的上海故事。以下是他自己的讲述。Hi
City Tales, my name is Christopher Sankavish. I am a writer and author and food industry consultant sometimes here in Shanghai. I've been in China for almost 20 years, and I have just published my first book called Yangpan. I came to Shanghai in summer 2005 at the end of July, a bit by accident. I had wanted to live in Hong Kong and when I was working as a chef, and I only wanted to work at the Peninsula Hotel, the Bandao Jodian, right on the harbor. And I couldn't get a job there because I was a 24-year-old young chef, and nobody would hire me, especially the Peninsula Hotel. But I ended up very by chance getting a position at the Pudong Shangri-La. In 2005, they had just opened their second tower. It was a 36-story tower, and there was a restaurant on the very top called Jade on 36. It's still there. It's the flagship restaurant for the Shangri-La Group. And this property at the time was their flagship property for all of China. So it was a lot of pressure. When I first came to Shanghai, I had never been here before. I had never been to mainland China before. I had no expectations, no experience. I didn't know anything about the country. I had been attracted to Hong Kong. But when I got the job offer for Shanghai, I decided that was better than going back to Miami, where I'm from. And sure, I would try it for a year. I arrived at night at the very end of July 2005 on a plane from Hong Kong, left the Pudong airport, got picked up by the hotel, driven throughout a lot of rural Pudong, the farmhouses and low buildings out there for about 45 minutes. And I thought that was Shanghai. I didn't have any expectations. I thought Shanghai was a big city. But I didn't know where I was going to be. Finally, after about 45 minutes and me thinking, well, I guess Shanghai is a small town and I'm going to be living in this small town for a year, we got into Lujiazui and I started to see the tall buildings and the Pearl Tower and the Jinmao Tower and the hotel that I would spend a year at. And I thought, oh, thank God, Shanghai is a big city. This is going to be okay. I came in on a wave of foreigners in Shanghai that followed the opening of Shanghai and the accession to the World Trade Organization. I think that was in 2001. And when that happened, there was really a big influx of foreign money, foreign workers, foreign professionals, foreign chefs, lots of people from overseas coming to try to make some money in China. And I didn't realize this until much later, but all I had to do was get close enough to China, to mainland China, and I would sort of get sucked into this tornado. It was like mainland China was a giant magnet, and it pulled in people from all around the world. And I was very close. I was in Hong Kong, and it pulled me in. I just got close enough and said, okay, I'm willing to go there. I ended up in Shanghai. I didn't have to try very hard to end up in Shanghai. And I think that's true for a lot of people who are not Chinese who came to Shanghai between the 2001 accession to the World Trade Organization, even until maybe the 2010 World Expo. Shanghai had a very magnetic attraction and pulled a lot of people in. And I sort of unintentionally was pulled in by that attraction in the early 2000s. Life in Shanghai at that time was never boring. The city was developing at a very, very, very fast rate. I was much younger. One of the things that I've always had an issue with is trying to separate what part of my experience was me being young and what part was the city developing. As I've aged, the city has become stricter. I become more boring. I become more conservative. The city has become more boring. The city has become more conservative. So it's a bit hard for me to say that the city was more fun back then, but the city was definitely more open back then. The city was in some ways more alive back then. There was a lot more sense of possibility. There was a lot more gray area for a lot of different businesses. There was a lot more sense that you could do what you wanted without too much repercussion. I was living in the bubble, the English language bubble or the foreign bubble. I didn't have that much interaction with China, to be honest with you, outside of my work. I tried to get out of the bubble through my work, through food, through talking to people like the guy selling Yangro Chuar at the shop on Shanxilu, or people at the Huxi Mosque Market, or people who were involved in Huayang restaurants. I think the biggest contact that me and my friends had outside of the bubble always came through food. It came through going to try different restaurants. It came from talking to the chefs at the restaurants, having Chinese friends take us to various restaurants that we didn't know about or that maybe we wouldn't have gone to otherwise. Sometimes they would invite us into their home and, you know, the parents would cook for us or they would cook for us. Sometimes we would invite them into our homes and we would cook for them. So there was some interaction that way. But for the most part, we lived in a different Shanghai.
Shanghai提到的 bubble circle 叫做泡泡圈。如果你也有过长时间海外生活或者留学的经历，你会知道华人在海外会有自己的生活小圈子。比如说，你可能经常和你的同学会腻在一起。 那在上海的外国人同样有自己的小圈子，并且有独属于自己的社交法则。而据沈凯伟观察，这个 bubble circle 以及它的规则和范围始终在变化之中。I
think when two cultures meet, the minority culture always forms a bubble or always forms their own community. And this is true of foreigners coming to China, foreigners coming to Shanghai, of Chinese going overseas, Chinese going to Africa or going to the United States or Canada or anywhere else. You create your own bubble. You create your own community. The contours of the bubble are generally defined by language. That's the biggest defining factor, but also by culture. For example, in Shanghai, there's a very big kind of umbrella bubble of all the foreigners. But then, especially during the 2000s and early 2010s, there were individual bubbles. There were country-specific bubbles. So there would be the Italian bubble and the Spanish bubble and the French bubble and all of these different bubbles and the Australian bubble. And those people may not have interacted with people outside of their little community as the number of foreigners grew, the number of bubbles grew as well within the big bubble. In the early years, the bubble was much more open, and within the bubble that you might have friends from all over the world who just didn't immediately fit into Shanghai. And that could include ethnically Chinese who had grown up in America, or Chinese people who had lived overseas and come back, people from all over Asia, people from any other country. And we all sort of became friends because we were all outsiders. Later on, the bubble became much more segregated. And like I said, there became country-specific bubbles and language-specific bubbles. And those, to a degree, still exist today. There's a Russian bubble that I don't know anything about, but I know exists here. There are small pockets of French communities. Generally, right now, what's happening in the bubble, because the number of foreign citizens in Shanghai has decreased, is that these small bubbles have started to pop, which means that instead of Italians just hanging out with Italians and Spanish hanging out with Spanish, now maybe the Italians hang out with the Spanish hang out with the French hang out with the Australians hang out with the British. So that's a change in the last 1, 2, or 3 years. The bubble encompasses all kinds of things. It's not just people getting together and speaking a language, but we have our own schools. We have our own hospitals. We have our own media. We have our own restaurants. We have our own places that we like to go. We had our own coffee shops. We had our own cocktail bars. We had places that we would hang out. And when we occupied, of course, all of this was in China, and so it's all Chinese, but when we occupied those places, we brought the bubble there. That's changed a lot, and one of the very small observations that I've made about that has to do with our hospitals. There's a lot of private hospitals in Shanghai. Their primary population, their primary customer, used to be foreigners and expats and some Chinese. And so when you would call them to make an appointment, for example, Parkway or Jiahui or Sino United or GHC, there's a lot of them. When you would call to make an appointment, the message would be recorded in English. Thank you for calling such place. If you'd like to make an appointment, press 1. If you need to speak to the operator, press 0. And then it would say, for Chinese, press 9. A few years ago, that completely changed as the number of foreigners fell and their customers became primarily Chinese. So that when you call to make an appointment now, the whole message is in Chinese, and at the end, in English, it says, for English, press 9. So that's been one specific but telling change of how things have changed. And for business people can no longer afford to focus on the foreign community as customers. It used to be common for restaurants to open and their customer base to be 80, 90, or almost even 100% foreign. And that's just not possible now. Now, even if a Western restaurant opens, they might only have 10 or 20% overseas customers, or at least foreign customers. So businesses have had to shift as well. So the bubble has shrunk a lot. The contours of the bubble have changed. The people within the bubble have changed as well. There was a big creative class. There was a big youth class. That was the class that I belonged to when I came. I was 24 when I arrived. There were a lot of other people my age here who were just coming to China, maybe after university, to look for adventure, to look for a job, to make money, just to spend some time here to see what it was like. And a lot of them and a lot of us got jobs in the media industry and the advertising industry and the education industry. All across Shanghai, there was this young and kind of creative class. And then as we grew up, we got better roles. And often people got transferred out of China because they got better roles, or people got sick of China and they moved back home, or they moved to other countries. They would go to Singapore or Thailand. Some recently, a lot of people go to Bali in Indonesia. That's where the bubble has sort of moved. I was there recently, and it's an even bigger bubble than Shanghai ever was. So a lot of people are moving out of the Shanghai bubble and moving into the Indonesia-Bali bubble. So things have changed tremendously. The bubble is much smaller than it used to be, and the people in it are a bit older, more professional, they have more ties to China because of the what happened in the last 2 years. People who are not strongly connected to China left. A lot of those people left. People who are just looking for an interesting place to do their job, or if they could work remotely, they left. They went other places. So that's had a big impact on businesses here. It's had a big impact on the foreign community. I think it's had a big psychological impact on the people who are left here, the people who chose to stay. So there's been a lot of change within the bubble. And I'm sure there are growing communities. I believe there is, from what I've seen, there are growing student communities from Eastern Europe and Russia, some from Africa. But that's quite different from what it was when I was young. The shape of the bubble in Shanghai is different than the bubble might be in other countries. It gets distorted by many things. Some of it is China's visas policy. Some of it is cultural. But for example, we don't have any lower or working class expats here. There are very, very few. In the eyes of the Shanghai government, at least, there are three levels of foreigner. There's Class A foreigner, Class B foreigner, and Class C foreigner. That's an official designation from the Shanghai government. I believe it's Shanghai, not China-wide. Class A foreigners are those who pay a lot of tax or work in professional industries or are in industries that the government is really interested in promoting, like maybe artificial intelligence or electric cars or something like that. If they work in those industries, they get classified as Class A foreigners. Easier for them to get a visa. For service industries like chefs or other people who work in service industries, there's not very many, but there are some. They are Class C foreigners, and the government is trying to eliminate those positions. And then most of us are Class B foreigners. We are the foreign middle class, I guess you would say. That's what I belong to. I am not working class, but I'm not professional class either. The visa policies shape the bubble primarily by not allowing a working class, which is totally fair. I understand why China doesn't do that. They don't need a lot of unskilled labor here. We have plenty of people here in China. We don't need to import anymore. But what that means is that the shape of the bubble or the characteristics of the bubble are distorted towards the professional class. And what that means is that when Chinese people see foreigners, I think, I could be totally wrong here, but I think they see us through this distorted lens because they think that we're all rich expats. They think that we're all Class A foreigners, so to speak. And they think that we all have this wonderful life where we live in apartments that cost 50,000 RMB a month, and we have cars and drivers, and we eat out at fancy restaurants all the time, and things are very easy for us. That's true for some people and even some of my friends. It's not true for me. But they don't see, for example, the single mother who has four children, who is just trying to work a job to support her four children. They don't see the foreign garbage man. They don't see the foreign street sweeper or hear the foreign customer service representative on the phone, the working class people. Because we don't have that working class here, I think we tend to, foreigners here tend to think they're a little bit better than they are in some ways because we're given a little bit more respect than we probably deserve. We're just regular people, but we are distorted towards that class. And then the other major distortion is that we don't have our families here generally, and specifically we don't have our parents here. We might have kids who were born here or came here when they were young. But our parents are not here. And so we are a rootless society. We don't have roots in this country, the type of roots that that parents give you. And we don't interact with the older generation, you know, who might be our parents' Chinese friends or our parents' Chinese colleagues. And so we exist in this liminal in-between state. We're not really grounded in a place that we have roots. We don't have our families here. But we also, if we have been here for a long time, we also have some sort of roots here. But in a very weird way.
对于在上海待了十多年仍然在租房的沈凯伟，这件中国人的恨事似乎同样成立。
Housing has been an issue for me since the day I arrived. When I came here, I was given 2 weeks to live in the Pudong Shangri-La while I found an apartment, which meant I immediately had to go out and look at houses to live in. And I looked at many different places, and the one that I finally chose wasan old lane on Nanjing Xilu called Jing'an Beishu, Jing'an Villas. It's a beautiful old lane, red brick, three-story row houses. The rent when I moved in 2005 was 4,350 RMB, and I stayed there for 6 years. At the time, I didn't know that I was going to stay in China as long as I have. Otherwise, I would have tried to buy an apartment.And I would be rich. But that didn't happen, because even in 2005, when I was working at the hotel, there were some older expats who had lived in China for many years by that point. They must have come in the late 80s or early 90s. And they were complaining that the housing market in Shanghai was a bubble back in 2005, and that prices were so high that new houses cost 30,000 RMB a square meter. And...How could anybody afford that? Well, by the time that I moved out of my 4,350 RMB apartment in Jing'an Villas, 6 or 7 years later, the price had gone from about 30,000 RMB per square meter to about 70,000 RMB per square meter. Today is probably well over 100,000 RMB per square meter. But even at the time, I couldn't have afforded it. In 2005, I was 24 years old.At 30,000 RMB a square meter, the house was only 50 square meters. You can do the math to figure out how much it costs, but I didn't have that money. My family didn't have that money. I couldn't borrow the money from them. I didn't know I was going to stay here. On top of that, Jing'an Beishu is a protected, this is a kind of a minor thing, but Jing'an Beishu is a protected heritage apartment complex. Foreigners were not allowed to, as I understand,or at least what my landlord and the owner of the apartment back then told me, foreigners are not allowed to buy those apartments. So I never invested in an apartment. One, I always thought that the prices were too high. Two, I never had the money. At first, I went from one low-paid profession, being a chef, to another low-paid profession, being a writer. I didn't have the amount of money that you needed to save up to be able to buy an apartment. And the prices were always going up. But I do have friends who did buy apartments, and I have a friend who bought the third floor of a lane house on the corner of Weihai Lu and Maoming Lu, which wasn't a very desirable location back then. It was just kind of an average location. But as the subway system expanded and as the old lane houses near him were torn down for the redevelopment of Zhangyuan, his house price has made him a millionaire. He continues to own the apartment. I think he bought it for 4.5 million RMB.And now it's worth 11 million RMB. That's a very common story. He bought it not that long ago. Now it's maybe 10 years ago. And he rents it out. There was a window there in the early 90s where you could have bought your apartment for much cheaper. And I wish I was here, and I wish I had the money, and I wish I did that. When I look at my neighbors now, I live in a Lao Gongyu on Fuxing Lu. And I rent.Because I've always rented. I've never been able to buy an apartment here, and I want to stay in downtown. And my neighbors bought their apartments in 1994 for 4,000 RMB per square meter, and they own three apartments in the building. They are millionaires, but they sure don't look like it. Those apartments are now worth about 150,000 RMB per square meter. I pay 14,000 RMB a month in rent.To be able to live downtown. I could find cheaper. I could also find much more expensive. I have another friend who lives around the corner from me in a very fancy Hong Kong-owned residential development. He pays 75,000 RMB a month for rent. He has 300 and something square meters for he and his wife and his young child and his two IEs. He lives in the same compound that the American consul general lives in. I also have friends who rent studio apartments in downtown for 4,000 or 5,000 RMB a month. They can just barely open the door to get into their space. They might have a shared kitchen or a shared bathroom. So I have friends all across the spectrum. Some are at the very top living very luxury lives in these very luxury apartments, and they're beautiful. And then you have people who are just trying to get by. One of the last apartments that I lived in before this one, I shared the kitchen with my neighbor. It was a big kitchen. It wasn't too bad. I actually renovated the kitchen a little bit. We repainted and cleaned both sides of it because it had not been cleaned for about 40 years and was grease and dust everywhere. Dust stuck to the grease. And we cleaned the whole thing, but I still had to share a kitchen there. There was a shared bathroom, but that was given just to her, given to my neighbor who was in her 80s. And we built a bathroom in the apartment that I was in. So one thing I've done that's different than a lot of other foreigners in Shanghai is I rent apartments and then I renovate them, but I live in them. About 5, 6, 7 years ago, a lot of other people had this idea, but they renovate the apartments and then they rent them out. So now the market is almost completely, for these older houses, is almost completely controlled by these arfangdong. But I find when I look for apartments, I go to the real estate agents in the neighborhood that I want to be in, and I ask, what is the worst apartment that you have? What is the most disgusting apartment you have? And I want to look at those. And then I go in and I sign a lease for 3 years or 5 years, and I have some construction guys who I've worked with for about 10 years who are really wonderful. Xiao Qian, his name is Xiao Qian. And we go in and renovate, and then I live there. And so that's always put me in a little bit of a different, not in a category of class of foreigner, but it puts me in a different philosophy because I have already rented someplace for 3 to 5 years. The expat philosophy here is basically see what happens this year and then whether you're going to stay or you're going to go. 过一年算一年. That's the reigning philosophy here, and that's related to visa issues. But I've had this philosophy that, well, maybe I'll leave in a year, but I might as well rent a place. And so that gives me some roots. And so I've had a lot of experiences with renting places, renovating them, and having long-term neighbors of all classes in Shanghai. There was a day in 2006 which I wanted to see the suburbs in Shanghai. Actually, I wanted to see nature. I saw Shanghai on a map, and I saw downtown on a map, and I thought, well, I can't go east because that just goes to the ocean. South goes to Hangzhou Bay. North goes to the Yangtze River. So I'll ride west and see how far I can ride in one day west. And maybe I'll finally break out of the suburbs and into nature. That was a mistake. I rode west as far as I could go. And I think I ended up, when I look back now, I think I was in Qingpu or maybe Hong, maybe somewhere around Hongqiao or somewhere in Minhang. I can't tell exactly. There was no countryside. It was all suburbs. Everything was being constructed at that time. All of the Xinzhuang was in Minhang was, there was almost nothing there. There were no malls. There were no shopping facilities. It was just a metro station that was being put there, and then they would build everything else around it. There were a few apartment blocks. Now those are big developed areas. They're small satellite cities in line with the Shanghai government's plan to develop the city. And that's fine. But I don't visit the suburbs very often anymore because I don't find them that. They're a place to sleep, maybe not really a place to live. If I had bought a property back then, for example, on my bike trip in 2006 into the suburbs, if I had bought one of those apartments that I saw being constructed, I would be a millionaire today too. But I never had the money for it. As a foreigner, you are allowed to buy one house in Shanghai, I believe. There are some restrictions. You have to have, I don't know, I'm not up to date with what they are right now, but they used to be that you had lived in Shanghai for a certain period of time. I believe you had to put a higher down payment than usual on the apartment. And I didn't have that money. Working as a writer doesn't give you enough money to buy a house in Shanghai. I do have friends who bought properties in the suburbs, who bought in Baoshan and then in Hongqiao, and then they're slowly upgrading. So now they live in Qingpu. I think they have a house in Qingpu, a big house in Qingpu.
24岁的沈凯伟在千禧年这一波中国主动向世界开放的浪潮中因缘机会来到上海，而传奇的是，在20世纪的晚清中国，当中国被迫结束世界之时，他的外高祖父在1867年同样是在他的24岁来到中国北京，并且度过余生。
The name of my book that just came out is Yangpan, Miami Qingnian, Shanghai Xiaolongbao. Yangpan, what I've learned, I didn't name the book. A very close friend of mine, Xu Junqian, named the book. And she's Shanghainese. From what I've learned, it's both a Shanghainese term and a term in Sichuanhua. But the Shanghainese meaning of the term is somebody who doesn't understand the local customs, somebody who's a bit of an idiot, somebody who just doesn't really understand how things work. And that's me. I am definitely Yangpan. Because the longer that I've been here, the less I understand how things work. And the less I understand how the city works, how the country works. When I came, I had no connection to China. Or at least I didn't know that I had a connection to China. My family came to visit in 2006. And I asked my parents what they wanted to do. And my mom said, well, we want to go visit your grandfather's church in Beijing. And I said, why would grandpa have a church in Beijing? She said, oh, well, you know, he was born in Beijing. I had no idea. So it turns out the story is my great-great-grandfather fought in the Civil War in the U.S. in the 1860s. After he came out of the war, he was tired of all the violence. He didn't want to see any more violence. And he enrolled in Bible school or in pastor school. And he graduated at the age of 24 in Ohio as a pastor. And he went to the Missionary Society that afternoon. The Missionary Society said, young Hiram, you are going to China. He arrived in China with his pregnant wife, who was also 24 years old, on October 10th in 1867 to Fuzhou, after taking a long steamership halfway around the world. He was one of the first missionaries to arrive by steamship, which were pretty new at that time. He spent 2 years in Fuzhou, working with the Fuzhou mission there, but they had trouble learning Fuzhou Hua, and they eventually decided that they would send my great-great-grandfather, Hiram, to Beijing to establish the North China mission. So he arrived in Beijing in 1869 with his now 26-year-old wife and his 2-year-old son. And he stayed there until 1923 or 1924. He stayed more than 60 years. He opened the church there called the Asbury Church. Now it's called Chongwenmen Jiaotang. He opened the church. He opened a school. He opened a hospital. And when I tell people this story, and I had no idea. And when I tell people the story, they often think, well, it's fate. Your family is just connected to China. You were meant to be here. And I think that's too simple of an explanation. There's another explanation, and that explanation is that China in the 1860s was newly open to the world after being forced open with the 5 treaty ports after following the Opium Wars. And China was modernizing a bit at that time. It was forced to become international, and there were a lot of foreign business people who were pouring into China, this newly opened China, wanting to make money off of the Chinese. And on the backs of those business people came the missionaries who wanted to save the souls of the Chinese people. This was their biggest mission possibility. This was their biggest potential for the entire world. The largest number of souls that could be saved in this country that had just opened. And so in a way, I think it's similar to what happened to me. We were both 24 when we arrived, my great-great-grandfather and I. And China pulled us in. China had this magnetic attraction back then, although the attraction was for business people, diplomats, and a lot of missionaries. And it had this magnetic pull when I was 24, when China was reopening and Shanghai was booming after the 2001 accession to the World Trade Organization. And so we just kind of had to get close enough to China to be pulled in by its magnetic attraction. He was sent here, but then he stayed for almost 60 years until he died. He's still buried somewhere in Beijing. His children stayed. They were raised in Beijing. And their children stayed and were raised in Beijing, who was my grandfather. And then he went back to the U.S. in the 1930s, I believe. So, was it fate? I don't think it's completely fate. Was it just China opening up to the world and then pulling in people from all over the world? I think that's part of it as well. I think the answer is a mix of those two. Beijing is a spiritual home for me. When I go to Beijing, I immediately feel at home. I feel really comfortable around people in Beijing. There's the car culture in Beijing, which reminds me of the car culture in the U.S. But more than that, I just kind of feel comfortable around the character of Beifang people and Northern Chinese. I don't know if some of that has to do with my family's history. Every time I visit Beijing, or almost every time I visit Beijing, which is pretty often, I go to give my respects to the church, even if they don't really recognize me or know who I am. Maybe they do now, but for most of the past 20 years, they don't know who I am. I feel quite at home in Beijing, but never as home as I do in Shanghai. Shanghai is my home. I don't call it my second home. I don't call it my other home. Shanghai is my home. I feel more comfortable in Shanghai in many ways than I feel when I'm back in Miami. Beijing has a lot of great things going for it, a lot of history, a lot of culture, being the diplomatic and governmental center of the country. There's a lot going on there. Expats in Beijing are very different than the expats in Shanghai. Their Chinese is better. They're here for China, or they have an interest in China. They're interested in history or culture or something like that, or at least that's the stereotype that we have of them. Expats in Shanghai are about money, or at least that's a stereotype that we have about them. But I'm very comfortable in Shanghai. It's a city that we can walk in, or at least the part that I live in is very walkable. Beijing, the streets are too big to walk around. I've considered moving to Beijing. I wanted to experience what it was like to live in the Chongwanman area, where the church is and where my family spent 60 years. But I just can't pull myself out of Shanghai to live in Beijing. The stereotype of foreigners in Beijing is that they're more interested in history and Chinese culture, and that they often are related to the governments. They are working for the embassies, or they're working for government organizations, and so that they are the better expats, so to speak. The expats in Shanghai always get the reputation as being the superficial expats. We are the expats who are here to party. We are here to live in the Shanghai bubble. We're here to live without speaking Chinese. We are here to make money. And so we are sort of, if there's a hierarchy of expats within China, among us, the perception is that the ones in Beijing are the better expats, the more moral expats, and the ones in Shanghai are the more degenerate expats. Of course, it's not totally true, but there is some truth to that. There is a big bubble in Shanghai, for sure. A lot of us enjoy living in that bubble. A lot of us never learn to speak Chinese or learn to speak Chinese at a high level. A lot of us don't have the interaction with people, with Chinese people, that we might have if we were living in Beijing, which is a less foreign environment.
牛油果阿姨和啤酒阿姨是《羊盘》这本书里沈开伟写到的两个有趣的人物。牛油果阿姨凭着一己之力成为早期沪上外国人采购牛油果的中心，而啤酒阿姨则抓住了连锁化的商机，成功的将她最早挑选的零零总总的精酿啤酒打造成了一个连锁的成功品牌。而他们正是沈凯伟所见识的融于个体叙事的上海全球化的故事。
One of the stories that I wrote in the book is about a woman who everybody calls the Avocado Lady. Of course, that's not her real name, but that's how everybody knows her. I don't think many people know her real name, although it's in the book. I think I met her in 2006 or 2007. She became a little bit of a sensation in Shanghai among expats for having things like fresh basil and pine nuts and smoked salmon, which were hard to find or expensive at that time. She also had avocados. Avocados at that time were very expensive. They only came from Mexico. You could buy them, but it was always in a foreign supermarket. They might be 30 or 40 RMB each, and the quality wasn't very good. The avocado lady is extremely clever. She's a very smart lady who came to Shanghai from Nantong in her 20s. She started as a carpet salesperson with her family and quickly realized that's not what she wanted to do. She rented a little stall on Urumqi Lu selling produce. In those early days, 2005, 2006, there was already a foreign population living around that area. And there was a French woman who liked to cook who became friends with the avocado lady. And she would ask the avocado lady to import specific foods for her. And one of the things that she asked for were avocados. Well, the avocado lady is very clever, and she went down to the wholesale market, the wholesale fruit and vegetable markets in the south part of Shanghai. And she asked the importers if she could buy a case of avocados. They said, well, we don't import those. She said, well, how am I going to get them? They said, you're going to have to pay a deposit to bring in, you know, a whole case or a whole box of avocados, because we don't believe that anybody is going to buy them. So she decided to take a risk, and she put down the deposit. She got the avocados. She put them outside her store. She didn't know how much to charge for them, so she charged her cost, which I believe was, at the time, 8 RMB each. She charged that. And very quickly, word spread around Shanghai that instead of paying 30 or 40 RMB for an avocado, there was this lady on Urumqi Lu who sold produce who was selling avocados for 8 RMB. So she sold out of the first batch of avocados, and she went back and she put down a deposit, and she got more avocados. And this time she raised the price to 9 RMB. And she did it again. She raised the price to 10 RMB. She always put them out front of her store next to the lemons. And pretty quickly she got a reputation for selling all kinds of foreign food items. As people would come to her and ask her, like this original French lady did, can you get me pureed sesame sauce from the Middle East? Can you get me hot sauce from the US? Can you get me this? Can you get me that? And she always said yes. She always spent her time studying the English words for the fruits and vegetables and spices and food that people wanted, so that when people came to her, she could speak to them in a little bit of English. And she made a living. She made a really good living doing this by selling foreign items to foreigners in the former French concession. And her signature item has always been the avocado, which I think now is about 12 RMB. She raised her prices to about 12 RMB. Well, back at that time, avocados weren't popular in China. Avocados have since become very popular in China. The number of avocados imported here has just gone up dramatically. It's one of the world's biggest markets for avocados. All the avocado companies want to be here. All the countries of South America want to export avocados to China. And so the market has changed. And the avocado lady is no longer that special. You can buy avocados anywhere in Shanghai. And you can buy them from Hema, and you can buy them online, and you can buy them from any supermarket and almost any produce stall. And so her story is one of kind of the early globalization and how she was able to be very clever and make her living enough to send her daughter to university for sports management. By reacting to this wave of foreigners who were moving into downtown Shanghai, and actually not even just downtown Shanghai, because her reputation was so big that people would travel from Pudong to go shop at her store. People would travel in from Huacao and Minhang to go shop at her little store. And eventually she took over the stall next to her. And so she has two storefronts, but she's still there. She's still there now. And right now, as we're recording, you know, in 2023, at the end of 2023, she works 361 days a year. She takes 4 days off for Chinese New Year. And otherwise, she's working there. She's brought her entire family to work here with her. She sent her daughter to university based on the money that she's made selling avocados. So she rode this kind of expat wave in Shanghai and did very well for herself. And that is all to her credit. She's a very smart lady. But her time has kind of passed. We don't really need the avocado lady anymore. I wrote another story about another woman who rode a kind of wave of globalization and internationalization in Shanghai, and that was about the beer lady. The beer lady I found one afternoon while I was out walking around, and she had a convenience store and had stocked about 100 different beers, and I had never seen that before. It was in 2015, and international craft beer was not a big industry in China at that time. So I immediately recognized that what she was doing was unique, and I went to go speak to her and ask her why. As most of my stories start off, I just kind of ask somebody why they're doing what they're doing. And she was a big fan of beer, and she had this small convenience store and thought, well, maybe I will just try to sell some of these beers, and if nobody buys them, I'm going to drink them and I'll enjoy them. I wrote the story, and the story went viral in Shanghai, and she has since gone on to open, I don't know how many locations she has all across the city, including, I think, a 4,000 square meter beer lady shop in Songjiang. And she rode the wave of the popularization of international craft beers in China and in Shanghai. I gave her the kind of spark of an idea, or I didn't give her the idea, but I gave her the first boost, the first push. And then she ran with it and turned it into a tremendous business. And she's a little bit different from the avocado lady. The avocado lady's market is primarily foreign. Her story is about serving the foreign community. But the beer lady's story is about Chinese domestic consumption. And it's about how the change in tastes for beer made her rich. I hope she's rich. She has a lot of stores now. I hope that she's been able to make her fortune out of those shops. But they certainly took her out of that convenience store that she was working in, where her primary business was selling photocopies for people for the police station across the street. And now she sells, I don't know how many hundreds of types of beer in her shop, some of which are open 24 hours, and primarily serve a Chinese audience, serve Chinese customers.
沈凯伟的经历和家族故事让人感到只把异乡做故乡这句老话有了一层全球化的深意。而如何处理所居之人甚至是外来者、外国人的认同与归属感，是像上海这样的全球城市必将面临的挑战。When
people ask me where I'm from, it can be a difficult question. I've grown up my adult life in Shanghai since I was 24 and I'm 43. I grew up for the first part of my life in Miami and in South Florida. And so I'm a bit half and half. Some people would say that this is a very cosmopolitan lifestyle, but I would disagree with that. I think cosmopolitan means that you can live anywhere in the world and that you're a world citizen. And I don't see myself as a world citizen. I see myself as a citizen of two countries, of America and of China. I don't want to leave China and pick up and start over in another country. I don't think that I'm the type of person that can just move around with no roots. And now my roots in China are much deeper than they were when I arrived and getting deeper every year. And so for me, the area that I live in around Fuxinglu is my home, and that feels like where my roots are. And Shanghai in general is a home for me. China, in the bigger sense of the picture, is also a home for me. So it's a bit difficult to answer the question exactly of where I'm from, and I'm a little bit caught between both worlds. When I go back to the U.S., I don't necessarily fit in. I have to ask my family or my friends how to talk about some subjects that I don't understand that are happening in the U.S. I have to relearn how to tip when I go to any type of place, because tipping is such a big thing in the U.S., and I don't understand how much we're supposed to tip and who we're supposed to tip and when we're supposed to tip. So I often get into these very awkward situations where I have to ask people, do I tip you? And then they don't know how to respond, and they think I'm really strange because they see my white face and assume that I should understand the culture. They don't necessarily understand. So I don't fit in completely there. And even as much as I feel that Fuxing Lu and that area and Shanghai in general is my home, I don't fit in here completely either. And it's not an issue of language. And it's not an issue of having a white face either. It's just an issue of having different ideas, I think, of looking at things a bit more critically and trying to look at things both objectively and understand why things are the way that they are, and also react to them subjectively, which is what I do in my book, which is see how things are and then sort of see how that's impacted me and how I feel about how they are or how I perceive how they are. And so all of that has made me into this kind of permanent outsider, this permanent person who doesn't really understand the local customs, who is permanently pushed to the side, permanently in the minority. One of the early names for this book was Permanently Temporary, before my friend Jun Chen came up with the name Yangpan. And I think Yangpan really is a very fitting description of who I am. It's also a little humorous. It's also a little bit funny and self-deprecating, and it's supposed to be. I don't try not to take myself too seriously. So it's okay for me to call myself a Yangpan. That's where I am today. I think in both places, in the U.S. and in China, in some ways, and some ways I don't fit in either place. And I understand some things about the U.S. very deeply, and I understand some things about China very deeply, and then everything else I really don't know.
大家好，这里是澎湃研究所《世说新语》工作室出品的播客节目《如此城市》。如果你喜欢我们的内容，请前往澎湃新闻客户端、苹果播客、小宇宙、喜马拉雅等平台搜索订阅收听。《世说新语》工作室将持续长久以来的澎湃研究所对于城市内容的挖掘和审视，进行有趣有料的音视频原创节目探索。请持续关注《如此城市》，我们下一期节目再会。